Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ben Beachy, Senior Policy Advisor with the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program, who discusses his group's response to leaked documents related to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Pilar Schiavo, an organizer with National Nurses United, who explains why her union supports Medicare for All and the struggle to have the Democratic Party adopt universal health care in their party platform. And Craig Aaron of the media democracy group Free Press, who talks about a recent federal appeals court ruling that upheld the FCC's net neutrality rules protecting an open internet. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Wisconsin's legislative redistricting map, which was used by Governor Scott Walker to consolidate his right-wing agenda, is now being challenged in federal court. The case argues that Republican leaders in the Badger State used redistricting to make it difficult for Democrats and progressives to block Walker's regressive agenda. If the lawsuit prevails in appeals court, the case, Whitford v. Nickel, could upend other Republican-drawn redistricting maps in states like Michigan, Ohio, Virginia, and Texas. Many legal observers think the case may come before the U.S. Supreme Court. Michael Lee, a lawyer for the Brennan Center for Justice, told the American Prospect the Wisconsin lawsuit is the most significant gerrymandering case in 30 years. The Wisconsin legislative map, which took effect in 2011, was designed in a closed-door meeting held at the offices of the Republican-leaning law firm Michael Best & Friedrich. The plan was so secret that GOP legislators had to sign a confidentiality agreement to look at it. The redistricting plan was passed by the state legislature after a single hearing. Opponents filed a lawsuit, and a three-judge panel slapped the Michael Best law firm with a $17,000 fine. But the Republican map has done its job very well. In the 2012 state assembly election, Democrats won 200,000 more votes than Republicans, but due to the strategically drawn maps, the GOP maintained control of the legislature with a 60-39 seat majority. Millions of low-wage California workers will celebrate in 2022 when the minimum wage is due to be increased to $15 an hour. Yet tens of thousands of part-time workers may still be mired in poverty since they rely on stringing together several part-time jobs to make ends meet. According to The Nation magazine, over 160,000 hourly workers in Silicon Valley are underemployed and forced to work multiple jobs. Half of these low-wage part-time service workers often earn lower hourly wages than full-time workers. According to the Community Labor Coalition Silicon Valley Rising, many part-time workers often don't know their work schedules week to week. As a result, they have a tough time saving money or spending time with their children. Moreover, few get any vacation days or the opportunity to earn retirement benefits. To bring economic stability to their part-time workforce, Silicon Valley Rising is pushing for San Jose voters to consider their Opportunity to Work initiative in a ballot measure this November. The proposal, if approved, would compel employers to offer full-time work to current part-time employees before they can hire new part-time workers. Russian tourists are returning to the Black Sea for summer relaxation as terrorism and geopolitics have cut off favorite vacation spots in Egypt and Turkey. Sochi, the site of the 2014 Winter Olympics, and the recently annexed Crimea Peninsula have gained new popularity for tourists, even if these locations lack the facilities many affluent Russians had been accustomed to in the Middle East. Tourists are also returning to out-of-the-way places like the breakaway region of Abkhazia. When the Soviet Union broke up in the early 1990s, middle-class Russians discovered resorts in Turkey and Egypt. But now, these summer destinations are too dangerous. In recent years, Sochi has seen several million more tourists arrive, staying at hotels and spas built for the Olympics. The Crimea has been a summer retreat for Russia's elite since Tsarist times. Since Russia's annexation of the territory and the ongoing civil war in eastern Ukraine, tourists are returning to Crimea in large numbers. The Russian government is investing heavily in Crimea's tourist industry, including the construction of a new road and rail bridge, which will be the longest bridge in Europe when it's finished by the end of 2018. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Among the free trade deals being negotiated by the U.S. in the remaining months of Barack Obama's presidency are the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership and the less well-known, but equally controversial, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. TTIP, if ratified, will create the world's largest free trade zone. But with Britain's vote to leave the European Union, the future of TTIP is now in doubt, as the Conservative government of outgoing UK Prime Minister David Cameron had been an important ally of the US in EU trade negotiations. After the 13th round of TTIP negotiations in May, Greenpeace Netherlands leaked 248 pages of classified documents covering two-thirds of the areas discussed at the secret trade talks. Critics of the trade deal say the documents reveal that if ratified, TTIP could lower EU standards in areas such as the environment and public health by giving U.S. companies the right to lobby the EU to make sure regulations do not stand in the way of U.S. corporate profits. Specific concerns relate to the possible erosion of EU regulations on climate change, food labeling, and approval of dangerous chemicals and pesticides, a claim denied by U.S. and EU trade negotiators. Your reporter spoke with Ben Beachy, senior policy advisor with the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program, who discusses his group's concern about the leaked documents and what they reveal about Washington's apparent goal to weaken environmental and climate protections.
The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is really cleaved out of much of the same mold as the highly controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not as far along in negotiations, but from what we've seen, from what leaks, there was just a big leak last week, we can see that many of the rules that are now finalized in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which still has to go before our Congress, are exactly what's being negotiated in the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the one with the EU, which the acronym is, it really is alphabet soup. The acronym is TTIP for the EU deal. So TTIP has a lot of the same rules, and in some ways, those rules would pose at least as much danger to U.S. climate policies if they were enshrined in an agreement with the EU as those that are in the TPP. And I can get to some specifics, but in one particular area that we're quite concerned about are these provisions that would grant new rights to fossil fuel corporations that are based in the European Union to challenge our climate protections, not in any court, but in private tribunals that are not accountable to any domestic legal system. And we've seen fossil fuel corporations increasingly using these provisions to go after climate protections and other environmental policies. And this would be really an unprecedented expansion of liability for our climate protections in the history of U.S. trade deals.
Well, I wonder if you'd summarize for us the reasons for rising opposition to the TTIP or TTIP in Europe, which has certainly been fueled by the recent leak by Greenpeace Netherlands of 248 pages of documents from the proposed trade agreement. I guess we can ask you to review what these documents say, which have contributed in large part to many opponents' worst fears about what this trade agreement is all about.
That's right. They really have. I mean, so I looked over all 248 pages, and climate change is not mentioned once in the leaks from last week. It's not the full text, but it's a large portion of the text. While it does not mention climate change, it does include a wide array of rules that would restrict the tools that the U.S. and the EU could use to tackle climate change. As one example, one set of rules that was revealed in the leaks is something that the U.S. and the EU have proposed called regulatory cooperation. And that sounds nice, but there are rules that would undermine our climate and environmental protections if they would be deemed harmful to transatlantic trade or investment. As an example, the U.S. has actually proposed rules in that chapter that would allow corporations, including fossil fuel firms, to petition a government for the, quote, repeal of a regulation on the basis that it has been become more burdensome than necessary to achieve its objective, given its impact on trade. That is, it may well be that you have a legitimate objective to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce climate pollution. But if a corporation, a fossil fuel corporation, thinks, well, you know, that's all well and good, but it has this, you know, it has a large impact on our ability to invest across the Atlantic, or a large ability on our ability to trade fossil fuels across the Atlantic Ocean, then they could petition for the repeal of that regulation using this trade agreement. So that's, you know, that's under the guise of so-called regulatory cooperation. What it really does is this so-called regulatory cooperation gives a new seat at the table for industry, including fossil fuel firms, to try to conform our policymaking process on both sides of the Atlantic to their interests, which again are fundamentally opposed to the goal of moving beyond fossil fuels and embracing a transition to 100% clean energy.
What are some of the issues here you think that could derail this trade agreement? Or do you think U.S.-European negotiators will eventually overcome their differences?
Yeah, it's a good question. If the leaks are any indication, they're nowhere close to overcoming the differences. And even if they would overcome those differences, they're nowhere close to overcoming what has become an extremely broad-based opposition in the EU, and I would say growing opposition here in the United States. You know, it'd be one thing if these trade deals were just actually about trade, about goods moving across borders, but these are trade deals that are writing rules that will have a fundamental impact on our daily lives, on the safety of our food, on the affordability of our medicines, and on the stability of our climate.
That was Ben Beachy, Senior Policy Advisor with the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program. Learn more about why there's growing opposition to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the Democratic presidential primary campaign, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders outlined many policy differences with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Under his call for a political revolution against the power of the 1%, some of the specific differences revolved around student debt, trade policy, and health care. And while Clinton changed her position months ago on trade policy, stating that she now opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, and has moved much closer to Sanders' call for free tuition at public colleges and universities, there has not yet been a meeting of the minds on health care. In debates, Sanders called for a universal single-payer program, also known as Medicare for All, that would cover every American, while Clinton repeated her claim that establishing such a system would put Obamacare in jeopardy. Some of Sanders' earliest and staunchest supporters were members of National Nurses United, the largest union of registered nurses in the U.S., which itself has long called for a Medicare for All-type health care plan. Roseanne DeMauro, executive director of National Nurses United, was appointed by Senator Sanders to the Democratic Party Platform Committee to represent his views on health care, but she was rejected by the Democratic National Committee. Subsequently, a plank to include support for Medicare for All was defeated by a 7-6 vote, with Hillary Clinton's representatives on the committee opposing the measure. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pilar Schiavo, an organizer with National Nurses United. Here she explains why her union supports Medicare for All and the struggle to have the Democratic Party adopt universal health care, not only as a right, but to spell out how the country can achieve that goal.
Medicare for All is a very simple solution. It just means that instead of having to wait until you're 65 to get a Medicare card, that you would get it when you're born. We already have Medicare. It's been around for, it's about to celebrate its 51st birthday. It provides health care to 20% of our population, which uses 80% of our health care and is still you know, afloat and successful. So if we were to add everybody into that, we know it would be a successful program. And, you know, with a lot of the cost savings, we can also improve upon it because, you know, Republicans have worked to really try and chip away and are constantly trying to privatize it. We always talk about wanting improved Medicare for all to make sure that it's a comprehensive benefit for everyone. So it's not something that would actually be just for those folks who can't afford health care or be something. It's separate from the ACA. It would be the new healthcare system, just like the ACA is our current healthcare system, right? It would be the step forward to finish the job of healthcare reform, to ensure that actually everybody has access to healthcare when they need it. Instead of right now, the reality is people have access to healthcare when they can afford it. So we're talking about healthcare as a right, and the Democratic Party, you know, and their platform have confirmed that healthcare should be a right, then making it a right means that people can access it when they need it and not just when they can afford it. When the Bernie appointees pushed for Medicare for All to be in the platform, it was voted down 6-7 with all of the Bernie appointees plus Barbara Lee in support of it and all of the Hillary appointees voting against it. And, you know, there was a really good response, I think, from Cornel West that kind of went viral on the internet, where he called them out because, you know, after that vote happened, people started talking about, you know, Bernie Sanders has done so much to move the issue forward of healthcare as a right, and we should reaffirm that. And Cornel West correctly pointed out that this is not just about words saying healthcare is a right. This is about actions and making real change that actually makes healthcare as a right a reality. And so to say that you support healthcare as a right and then vote down Medicare for All that could actually make healthcare a right is contradictory. And so, you know, that's kind of where the divide is right now within the platform, is that, you know, there's some good language that sounds good and sounds like the Democratic Party is supportive of healthcare as a right, but how are they going to get there? This is something that 81% of Democrats support, a Medicare for All-like system. There's no reason that Democrat leadership wouldn't be supporting it. And until they do, you know, people are going bankrupt, they're dying, and they're waiting for the Democratic leadership to catch up with them.
Pilar Schiavo, there was a breakthrough last week between the Sanders and Clinton campaigns around the issue of free college education, where Hillary has now said she'd support free public college for families making under $125,000 a year. You haven't heard of any such breakthrough on the issue of Medicare for All?
We know that there are conversations going on around healthcare with the Bernie campaign and Hillary's campaign. And as of now, I don't know that there's been any resolution to that. So it's unfortunate because Secretary Clinton used to be a single-payer supporter. She used to talk about this as the solution for a very long time, and it's until this, you know, primary season that she decided to really kind of turn on the issue, and in a lot of ways, I think, has made it very difficult for herself to come back around and support it because she went on the attack around it. She and folks who support her in the media really spread a lot of misinformation about astronomical costs that are completely false. And so now she's kind of put herself in a corner on this issue where it's easy to explain away the misinformation, but unfortunately she also was the deliverer, and her surrogates were the deliverer of that misinformation. So she'd have to explain away why she was spreading that misinformation. It's easy to explain, you know, the misinformation around costs and things like that, because every study that's ever been done shows that Medicare for All would save money, it would save lives, it would cover everybody. So that the facts are actually can't be disputed, even though they tried to in the primary, but there's actually no study that can back them up. But unfortunately, politics and facts don't always align.
That was Pilar Schiavo, an organizer with the National Nurses United Union. Find more information on the campaign to establish a universal single-payer healthcare system in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 26th, the Federal Communications Commission voted in favor of new regulations that reclassified broadband internet as a public utility under Title II of the Communications Act. The new rules prohibit internet service providers, including cellular carriers, from blocking, slowing down, or speeding up online traffic or giving priority to web services in exchange for payment. But the U.S. Telecom Association, an industry group representing providers including Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, launched a legal challenge to scrap the FCC net neutrality rules, arguing that the new regulations threaten innovation and undermine investment in broadband infrastructure. A central issue was whether or not the FCC had the authority to reclassify internet providers as utilities after a previous attempt to mandate net neutrality rules was struck down by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in 2014. However, on June 14th, that same court rejected the industry challenge and upheld the FCC's net neutrality rules, stating that the Commission exercised its proper authority when it reclassified broadband internet access as a telecom service under Title II of the Communications Act. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press, one of the nation's leading net neutrality advocacy organizations. Here he reviews the recent court decision and his group's hard-fought victory, as well as the ongoing fight for a universal, affordable, and open internet.
Net neutrality really is just a way of saying no discrimination. And it means when you go online, you can go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want. It's not up to your phone or cable company to decide which websites are going to work and which won't. And for nearly a decade now, we've been fighting in Washington to protect net neutrality. And through some previously, I think, unfortunate court decisions and a lot of unwillingness in the past of the Federal Communications Commission to act, net neutrality was really in jeopardy. We were facing a future of the internet that, you know, doesn't look like the free and open internet we've enjoyed, but looks a lot more like cable television. But we saw a big reversal thanks to really an unprecedented amount of public pressure, millions and millions of people contacting the Federal Communications Commission throughout 2014 and 2015, finally getting the FCC, which had attempted time and again to pass really watered-down net neutrality rules, finally getting them to stand up, do strong net neutrality rules, really restore their authority under the Communications Act, authority that had been sort of abdicated during the Bush administration, restore it, make sure they can make strong rules and step in if phone or cable companies are messing with people's internet experience. And this has been a long fight, but a good one in a lot of ways, because it really shows when you don't accept those compromises, when you don't go back into court with sort of half measures, you actually can win. And that's what happened here. The FCC finally did the right thing, went in with their strongest legal case, and they were awarded for doing so. The judges at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on a 2-1 decision ruled completely for the FCC. They won on every issue in the case, and this was really a resounding defeat for the phone and cable lobby and for their very expensive lawyers that they sent in to try to overturn those FCC rules.
Craig, I wanted to just explore with you in the couple of minutes we have remaining about future challenges, because certainly the fight for unfettered communication in our country and new technologies and ensuring there is an even playing field so we can utilize these new technologies on an equal basis, that fight is far from over. And I know your group is continuing to push in many different directions, FCC enforcement of the rules now on the books and upheld by this court, as well as access. Access to the internet is huge, and I know that's something on your agenda.
In terms of the FCC taking action, you know, certainly we want to make sure that now that they won this case, now that they have this authority, that they're going to be willing to step in and use it if there are, violations. That's sometimes been a problem at the FCC in the past, an actual willingness to take action. So we'll definitely, as we see violations emerge, you know, definitely be stepping in to sound the alarm. Probably the most immediate concern is actually Congress. You know, there's a suite of bills. I think I counted six different measures, these riders that are trying to be snuck into must-pass budget bills as we speak this week in Washington, trying to really attack both of these issues, trying to prevent the FCC taking away their budget to enforce these rules. There are attempts to undo some very common sense reforms on issues like set-top boxes that they want to put forward. There's an attack on the Lifeline program, which the FCC is trying to extend to broadband, which is an essential program for connecting poor folks to phones. Now an opportunity to extend that to broadband, but the Republicans in Congress are moving to stop that. So there's a lot of work still to be done to get these riders out of the budget bill, to make sure that all of Congress and the president are aware of they're in there, so they can be cut out of these bills if they're negotiated and they go through the Senate. We've been successful in doing that a number of times, but they do keep coming. So the fights will continue to come. These companies haven't given up, unfortunately. You know, they may try to appeal to the Supreme Court. I think they have a very weak case, but they have a limitless budget. So they'll continue to try to make it difficult for the FCC. We've come a long, long way in actually getting an agency to do the right thing for once. Now we have to protect that and make sure they actually use the power that they have when we need it. We have a real competition problem in this country, and that's proving to be an incredible barrier for people getting online. So I think this is going to be one of the big priorities. We're really pushing the presidential candidates and the political parties to address this crisis of affordability, to prioritize Internet access for all. We just put together a whole big platform that includes a number of issues, but access is one of the pillars. Internet policy platform for 2016, which about 18 different public interest groups signed.
That was Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group FreePress.net. Find more information on groups working to preserve and expand Internet freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.